Discourse on Metaphysics by G. W. Leibniz, first published in 1686. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Sections 26 through 37. 26. To get a good grip on what ideas are, beware of an ambiguity. Some people take an idea to be an aspect or property of our thought, so that we have the idea in our mind only when we are thinking of it, and whenever we think of it again, we have different but similar ideas of the same thing. Other people, however, seem to take an idea to be the immediate object of a thought, or to be some kind of permanent form, which continues to exist even when we are not contemplating it. I side with the latter group, and here is why. Our soul always possesses the ability to represent to itself any nature or form when the occasion for thinking of it arises. This ability is always there, even though the individual thoughts in which it is exercised come and go. And I believe that this ability of our soul, when it expresses some nature, form, or essence, is properly called an idea of the thing. And it is in us, always in us, whether or not we are thinking of the thing. For our soul always expresses God and the universe, and all essences as well as all existences. That requires our soul to have ideas of all those things at all times, which it can do only if ideas are abilities, rather than individual mental events or aspects or properties of such events. This fits in with my principles, for nothing naturally enters our mind from outside, and it is a bad habit of ours to think of our soul as receiving messenger items from outside, as if it had doors and windows. We have all these forms in our mind, and indeed always have had, because the mind always expresses all its future thoughts, and is already thinking confusedly of everything it will ever think clearly. We couldn't be taught something unless we already had the idea of it in our mind, the idea being like the matter out of which the thought is formed. Plato understood this very well when he put forward his doctrine of reminiscence. This is very sound, provided we take it in the right way, cleansing it of the error about pre-existence, and not taking it to mean that if a soul takes in and thinks about something now, it must have clearly known and thought about it earlier. He also confirmed his opinion by a beautiful experiment. He introduces a small boy, whom he gradually leads to an acceptance of very difficult geometrical truths, without teaching him anything, only asking him an orderly sequence of suitable questions. This shows that our souls have virtual knowledge of all these things, that to grasp truths they need only to have their attention drawn to them, and thus that our souls at least have the ideas on which those truths depend. They might even be said to possess these truths, if we consider the truths as relations between ideas. 27. Aristotle preferred to compare our souls to as yet blank tablets that could be written on, and he held that there is nothing in our understanding that doesn't come from the senses. This squares better with everyday notions, as Aristotle usually does, unlike Plato, who goes deeper. Ordinary usage does sanction these doctrines or rules of thumb, in the spirit in which people who follow Copernicus still say that the sun rises and sets. Indeed, I often find that we can give them a good sense in which they are entirely true, and not merely things it is all right to say. For example, as I said earlier, it can be said truly that particular substances act on each other, and that we receive knowledge from outside by the agency of the senses, because some external things contain or express more particularly the reasons why our soul has certain thoughts. But when we are pursuing precise metaphysical truths, it is important to recognize how much our soul contains and how independent it is of other things. These, its extent and its independence, go infinitely further than plain folk imagine, although in ordinary talk we attribute to the soul only what we are most plainly aware of, only what belongs to us in one special manner, because there is no point in going any further. Still, it would be good to choose specific terms for each way of talking, so as to avoid ambiguity. So all expressions that are in our soul can be called ideas, whether or not they are conceived or formed in a consciously self-aware manner. The ones that are thus conceived can be called notions or concepts. But in whatever way we take the term notion, it is always false to say that all our notions come from the so-called external senses. For my notion of myself and of my thoughts, and therefore of being, substance, action, identity, and many others, come from an internal experience. 28. Now, in strict metaphysical truth, God is the only external cause that acts on us, and he alone affects us directly in virtue of our continual dependence. Therefore, no other external object touches our soul and directly triggers our perceptions. So it is the continual action of God upon us that enables us to have in our souls ideas of all things. Here is how that happens. All effects express their causes, and so the essence or intrinsic nature of our soul is a particular expression, imitation or likeness of God's essence, thought, and will, and of all the ideas contained in it. So we can say that God alone is our immediate external object, and that we see everything else through him. When we see the sun and the stars, for example, it is God who gave us the relevant ideas, and who conserves them in us, and who, by his ordinary concurrence, following the laws he has established, brings it about that we actually think of them when our senses are suitably disposed. God is the sun and the light of souls, the light which lighteth every man that cometh into this world, as the Bible says. And this is not a new opinion. In addition to Holy Scripture and the Church Fathers, who have always favoured Plato more than Aristotle, I remember having sometimes noticed that many people in the time of the Scholastics held that God is the light of the soul, or, as they used to say, the active intellect of the rational soul. 29. However, I don't share the opinion of some able philosophers, most notably Malebranche, who seem to maintain that our ideas themselves are in God, and not at all in us. In my view, this comes from their having partly grasped, but not yet thought through, the points I have just been making about substances and about the whole extent and independence of our soul, points implying that the soul contains everything that happens to it, and expresses God, and with him all possible and actual beings, as an effect expresses its cause. Anyway, it is inconceivable that I should think with someone else's ideas. Furthermore, when the soul thinks of something, it must actually come to be in a certain state, and it must have contained in advance not only a completely determinate passive power of coming to be in that state, but also an active power in virtue of which its nature has always contained signs that it was going to produce this thought eventually, and dispositions to produce it when the time comes. And all this, the passive power, the active power that includes the forward-looking signs and the disposition, has wrapped up in it the idea involved in the thought. 30. As regards God's action on the human will, there are a number of quite difficult issues that it would be tedious to pursue here. An outline of what we can say about it is as follows. In his ordinary concourse with our actions, God merely follows the laws he has established. That is to say, he continually preserves and produces our being in such a way that our thoughts occur spontaneously and freely in the order laid down by the notion of our individual substance, in which they could be foreseen from all eternity. Furthermore, he determines our will to choose what appears to us the best, by decreeing that our will shall always tend towards the apparent good, thus expressing or imitating the will of God to the extent that this apparent good has, as it always does have, some real good in it. In doing this, he does not necessitate our will. Absolutely speaking, our will is in a state of indifference, as opposed to necessity. It has the power to do otherwise, or to suspend its action altogether. Each alternative is always possible for it. So it is up to the soul to take precautions against being caught off its guard by events that come into its ken. And the way to do this is to resolve firmly to be reflective, and in certain situations not to act or judge without mature and thorough deliberation. It is true, however, and indeed it was settled from all eternity, that a particular soul will not employ this power to pause, reflect, deliberate on some particular occasion. But whose fault is that? Does the soul have anyone to complain of except itself? Any complaint after the fact is unfair if it would have been unfair before. But would it have been decent for this soul, just before sinning, to complain against God as if he were determining it to sin? What God determines in these matters cannot be foreseen. So how could a soul know that it was determined to sin unless it was already doing so? It is simply a matter of not choosing to, and God couldn't have set an easier or fairer condition than that. And accordingly, judges do not look for the reasons that led a man to have an evil intent, but concern themselves only with how evil it is. But perhaps it is certain from all eternity that I shall sin. Answer that to yourself. Perhaps not. And instead of dreaming on about what you can't know and can't learn from, act according to your duty, which you do know. But how does it happen that this man will certainly sin? The reply is easy. It is that otherwise it wouldn't be this man. For God sees from all time that there will be a certain Judas whose notion or idea, which God has, contains that future free action. That leaves only the question of why such a Judas, the traitor, who in God's idea is merely possible, actually exists. But no reply to that question is to be expected here on this earth, except that in general we should say, since God found it good that Judas should exist, despite the sin that he foresaw, this evil must be repaid with interest somewhere in the universe. God will extract some greater good from it. And the bottom line is that this course of events, the actual one that includes the existence of this sinner, will turn out to be the most perfect out of all the possible ways things could have gone. But while we are journeying through this world, we cannot always explain the admirable economy of that choice. We must settle for knowing it without understanding it. And at this point, it is time to acknowledge the richness and unfathomable depth of the divine wisdom, and not look for a detailed account of it, an account that would be infinitely complex. It is quite clear, though, that God is not the cause of evil. Man's soul has been possessed by original sin ever since he lost his innocence, but that was not the start of it. Even before that, all created things, just because they were created, were intrinsically limited or imperfect in a way that makes them capable of sin and of error. St. Augustine and others have held that the root of evil lies in nothingness, and I think that this should be taken as saying what I have just said, namely that evil comes from the deficiencies and limits of created things, which God graciously remedies by the degree of perfection that he is pleased to give them. This grace of God in both its ordinary and extraordinary versions varies in how deep and wide it goes, but it is always enough not only to save a man from sin, but also to secure his salvation as long as he uses his own resources to cooperate with that grace. It is not always sufficient to overcome a man's inclinations. If it were, his inclinations would have no effect on anything, and he would no longer be responsible for anything. That kind of sufficiency belongs only to absolutely effective grace, which is always victorious, whether through itself or through the combination of circumstances. 31. Finally, God's graces are purely gifts, and creatures have no claim on them. We can't fully explain how God chooses to distribute them by appealing to his foreknowledge, whether absolute or conditional, of how men are going to act in the future. But we mustn't think of them as arbitrary decrees for which there are no rational grounds. As for God's foreknowledge of our faith or good works, it is quite true that God has chosen only those whose faith and charity he foresaw, foreseeing that he would endow them with faith. But the old question comes up again. Why will God make a gift of faith or of good works to some people and not to others? A difficulty about this arises from the fact that grace is effective in a man only to the extent that he brings something of himself to it. Although to act well, a man needs to be stimulated to the good, and converted, he must also then do it by means of his own resources. And men vary in what their inner resources are, corresponding to how they vary in what grace is given them. So included in God's knowledge is not only his foresight of faith and of good deeds, but also his foresight of what a man himself will contribute towards them, his natural dispositions in that direction. It seems to many thinkers that we could say this: God sees what a man's natural dispositions will be, and thus what he would do without grace or extraordinary assistance, or at least what he will contribute from his own side in addition to anything that may be contributed by grace. So God could have decided to give grace to those whose natural dispositions were the best, or at any rate were the least imperfect or sinful. But if that were so, those natural dispositions, to the extent that they are good, are also the effect of grace, ordinary grace this time. Because in this respect, too, God has favoured some people more than others. Now, according to this doctrine, God knows perfectly well that the natural advantages he gives will be the ground for his grace or extraordinary help. So doesn't everything ultimately depend on his mercy? Well, we don't know how, or how much, God takes account of natural dispositions in his dispensing of grace. So I think that the most exact and the safest thing to say is what is dictated by my principles, and I have already said it once. Namely, among possible beings there must be the person of Peter or of John, whose notion or idea contains this whole sequence of ordinary and extraordinary graces, and all the rest of these events with their circumstances. And from amongst an infinity of other equally possible people, it pleased God to choose that person for actual existence. After this, it seemed that there is nothing more to ask, and that all the difficulties disappear. For as to this single great question, why it pleased God to choose this person from among all other possible persons, it would be very unreasonable not to be satisfied with the general reasons I have given, the details being beyond us. So, instead of having recourse to an absolute and arbitrary decree that is unreasonable because there are no reasons for it, or to reasons that fail to resolve the difficulty because they need reasons in their turn, it would be best to say, in agreement with St. Paul, that there are certain great reasons for God's choices, reasons of wisdom or of fitness that are unknown to mortals. God has conformed to these reasons, which are founded on the general order whose aim is the greatest perfection of the universe. The themes of the present work, the glory of God, and the manifestation of his justice, his mercy, and his perfections generally, and finally the immense profundity of riches that enraptured the soul of St. Paul, all come down to that in the end. 32. I have to add only that the thoughts I have just been explaining, especially the great principle of the perfection of God's operations, and that of the notion of a substance containing all its events with all their circumstances, so far from harming religion, serve to reinforce it. These thoughts sweep away some very serious difficulties, inspire souls with love of God, and elevate minds to the understanding of incorporeal substances, doing all this far better than did any previous theories. For it is quite clear that all other substances depend on God, as thoughts emanate from our substance and in that way depend on it, that God is all in all, and is intimately united to all created things in proportion to how perfect they are, that he alone, by his influence, determines them from outside. Elaborating this last point, if to act on something is to effect it immediately, i.e. directly, which is correct in the strict language of metaphysics, it can be said that in this sense only God acts on me and can do me good or harm. Other substances cannot, strictly speaking, help or harm me, because they contribute only to God's reason for making those changes. The other substances do come into those reasons, because God takes account of all substances when he shares out his blessings and makes them adjust to one another. So it is he alone who produces the connection or interplay among substances. He brings it about that the states of one coincide or agree with those of another, and as a result, that one substance can correctly perceive what state another is in. But we needn't always mention the universal cause in particular cases, and in common parlance, the items that we say act on a given substance, putting it into a certain state, are the ones that enter into God's reasons for putting it into that state, in the sense that I explained above. We can also see that every substance has a perfect spontaneity, that everything that happens to it is a consequence of its idea or of its nature, and that nothing affects it from outside except God alone. In substances with intellect, this spontaneity becomes freedom. This is why a certain person of very lofty mind and revered holiness used to say that the soul should often think as though there were only God and it in the world. Nothing can make us understand immortality better than this independence and extent of the soul, which absolutely shelters it from everything external, since it alone constitutes its whole world, and together with God is sufficient for itself. It is possible for the soul to come to an end through absolute annihilation, but its coming to an end in any other way, being destroyed by dissolution, through damage, like a machine, is just as impossible as it is that the world should destroy itself unaided. Changes in the extended mass we call our body could not have any effect on the soul, nor could the dissolution of that body destroy what is indivisible, namely the soul. 33. We also see how to clear up that great mystery of the union of the soul and the body. How does it come about that the passive and active states of the one are accompanied by active and passive states, or anyway by corresponding states, in the other? This is a mystery, because it is utterly inconceivable that the one should influence the other. And it is not reasonable to fall back on the extraordinary operation of the universal cause, God, to explain normal everyday events. Here, however, is the true explanation of those events. I have said that whatever takes place in the soul, or in any substance, is a consequence of its notion, so that the mere idea or essence of the soul carries with it the requirement that all the soul's states or perceptions must arise spontaneously from its own nature. And they must do this in just such a way that they correspond, unaided, to whatever happens in the whole universe, but more particularly and more perfectly to what happens in the body assigned to the soul in question. That is because, in a way and for a time, the soul expresses the state of the universe through the relation of other bodies to its own. This also tells us how our body belongs to us without being attached to our essence. And I believe that people who know how to think long and hard will favour my principles for just that reason, that they will be able to easily see what the connection between soul and body consists in, a connection that seems otherwise to be inexplicable. We can also see that the perceptions of our senses, even when they are vivid, must contain some confused feelings. For since all the bodies in the universe are in harmony or correspondence, our body receives the impressions of all the others. And although our senses are related to everything, our soul cannot possibly attend to each particular thing. Thus our confused feelings result from a downright infinite jumble of perceptions. In somewhat the same way, the confused murmur that people hear when nearing the seashore comes from putting together the reverberations of countless waves. for his several perceptions don't fit together so as to make one, and no one of them stands out above the rest, and the impressions they make are all just about equally strong and equally capable of catching the soul's attention, it can perceive them only confusedly. 34. In this section, I use the notion of unum per se, a Latin phrase meaning a unity through itself. This applies to anything whose intrinsic nature makes it one, single, and individual, as distinct from something that is not inherently one, though it may suit us to treat it as one. Each organism is an unum per se. A pile of leaves or a gallon of water is not. If we suppose that bodies that compose an unum per se, such as the body of a man, are substances, and that they have substantial forms, and that lower animals have souls, we must acknowledge that these souls and substantial forms cannot completely come to an end, any more than, in the view of other philosophers, atoms or the ultimate parts of matter can come to an end. For no substance ever comes to an end, though a substance may greatly alter. These souls or substantial forms of lower animals also express the whole universe, although more imperfectly than minds do. But the principal difference between them and minds is that they don't know what they are or what they do, and so, not being able to look into themselves reflectively, they can't discover necessary and universal truths. That is because the way to discover necessary truths is to look into oneself and see how one's ideas are interrelated. For lack of such self-reflection, they have no moral quality, which means that as they pass through hundreds of transformations, as when a caterpillar changes into a butterfly, it would make no moral or practical difference if we said that they cease to exist. We can even say that they really do cease to exist, as when we say that bodies perish through dissolution. But the thinking soul, which knows what it is and can say that pregnant word, I, not only, as a matter of metaphysics, is much more enduring than the others, but also, as a matter of morals, endures and constitutes the same person. For the memory or knowledge of this I is what makes the thinking soul capable of punishment and reward. Similarly, the immortality required by morality and religion doesn't consist merely in the lasting forever that all substances have, for that would not be something to hope for if it didn't involve the memory of what one has been. Suppose that someone could suddenly become the king of China, but only on condition of forgetting what he had been, as if he had just been born all over again. Would it not, in practice, or in terms of perceivable effects, be the same as if he had been annihilated, and a king of China created then and there? And that is something that that individual could have no reason to want. 35. In those remarks, I have been separating morality from metaphysics, but in some context, we must run the two in a single harness. To show by natural reasons that God will preserve forever not only our substance, but also our person, that is, the memory and the knowledge of what we are, we must unite morality with metaphysics. That is, we must think of God not only as the root cause of all substances and of all beings, but also as the leader of all persons or thinking substances, or as the absolute monarch of the most perfect city or republic. And that's what the universe composed of the assembled totality of minds is, the most perfect republic. For minds certainly are the most perfect of beings, and express God best. If bodies are only true phenomena, that is, reliable appearances to minds, then minds are the only substances there are, and if they are not that, they are at any rate the most perfect. And since, as I have sufficiently explained, the expressing of God and the universe is the whole nature, goal, virtue, or function of substances, there is no room to doubt that substances that do this knowing what they are doing, and able to understand great truths about God and the universe, express them incomparably better than the natures that belong to lower animals, and are incapable of knowing any truths or, lower down still, to things that lack feeling and knowledge altogether. The difference between substances that think and ones that don't is as great as that between a mirror and someone who sees. God can have conversations, so to speak, with minds, and can even enter into society with them by telling them what he thinks and wants, doing this in a special way that lets them know and love their benefactor. Since he himself is the greatest and wisest of minds, it is natural to think that minds, thinking substances, must concern God infinitely more than all other things, which can serve only as the tools of minds. Similarly, we see that wise folk always value a man infinitely more than any other thing, however precious it may be. And it seems that the greatest satisfaction an otherwise contented soul can have is to see itself loved by others. Between our love for one another and our love for God, however, there is a difference. His glory and our worship could not add to his satisfaction, because his sovereign and perfect happiness leads to the knowledge that created things have, and so cannot be partly caused by that knowledge. However, whatever is good and rational in finite spirits is also possessed by God in a suitably higher form. And just as we would praise a king who preferred to save the life of a man rather than of the most precious and rarest of his animals, so we should not doubt that the most enlightened and just of all monarchs would think the same. 36. Minds are actually the most perfectible of substances, and their perfections have the special feature that they obstruct one another the least, or rather that they help one another. From which it plainly follows that God, who always aims at the greatest perfection in general, will have the greatest care for minds, and will give to them, not only in general, but also to each particular mind, the highest level of perfection that the universal harmony will allow. God's being a mind is what qualifies him as the reason why things exist. If he couldn't voluntarily choose the best, there would be no reason why one possible thing should exist rather than some other. So of all the features of created things that God takes into account, he attends first and foremost to the quality that he shares with them, namely that of being a mind. Only minds are made in his image, are of his race, so to speak, are like children of his house, for only they can serve him freely and act in imitation of the divine nature, knowing what they are doing. A single mind is worth a whole world, since it not only expresses the world, but also knows it, and governs itself there after the fashion of God. Thus it seems that although each substance expresses the entire universe, minds express God rather than the world, whereas other substances express the world rather than God. And this nobility in the nature of minds, bringing them as near to divinity as is possible for mere created things, leads to God's deriving infinitely more glory from them than from any other beings. That is why this moral quality of God's, which makes him the Lord or King of minds, is one in which he takes quite special interest, an interest that might be called personal. It is in this that he humanizes himself, willingly lays himself open to being thought of in anthropomorphic ways, and enters into society with us as a prince does with his subjects. This concern is so dear to him that the happy and flourishing state of his empire, which consists in the greatest possible happiness of the inhabitants, becomes the highest of his laws. For happiness is to people what perfection is to beings in general. And if the ultimate explanation of the existence of the real world is the decree that it should have the greatest perfection that it can, then the ultimate aim for the moral world, the city of God, the noblest part of the universe, should be to infuse it with the greatest possible happiness. So we mustn't doubt that God, in order that his city should never lose any person, as the world never loses any substance, has arranged everything so that minds not only, of course, can live forever, but also retain forever their moral quality. Consequently, they will always know what they are. Otherwise, they wouldn't be liable for reward or punishment, which are essential to any republic, and especially to the most perfect one, where nothing could be neglected. In fact, since God is at once the most fair and mild of kings, and since he demands of his subjects only a good will, provided it is sincere and serious, the subjects couldn't wish for a better condition. To make them perfectly happy, God asks only that they love him. 37. Ancient philosophers knew very little of these important truths. Only Jesus Christ expressed them divinely well, and in such a clear and down-to-earth way that even the dullest minds could understand them. Thus his gospel has entirely changed the face of human affairs. He has told us about the kingdom of heaven, that perfect republic of minds meriting the title City of God, whose admirable laws he has revealed to us. He alone has shown how much God loves us, and how exactly he has provided for everything that affects us, that, caring for sparrows, he will not neglect the rational creatures who are infinitely dearer to him, that all the hairs of our heads are counted, that the sky and the earth will perish before any change in the word of God, or in any of the conditions for our salvation, that God cares more about the least of thinking souls than about the whole machine of the world, that we need not fear those who can destroy bodies but could not harm souls, because God alone can make souls happy or unhappy, that the souls of the just are, in his hands, safe from all the revolutions of the universe, since nothing can act on them except God alone, that none of our actions is forgotten, that everything is taken into account, even an idle remark or a well-used spoonful of water, and finally, that all must result in the greatest well-being for good people, that the righteous shall be like sons, and that we have never experienced or conceived anything giving us a foretaste of the happiness that God prepares for those who love him. End of sections 26 through 37. End of the work.